is interested about some of the demonstrations now, I mean, particularly with the anti-globalisation and with the Occupy movement, what's happening is they're bringing together many, many diverse sort of groups, you know, all sorts, from the Socialist Worker Party, animal rights, anarchists, you know. They're really quite broad-based, and a very key element in that is a kind of an anti-capitalist kind of theme comes through. But, of course, they're not necessarily anti-capitalist. I mean, for instance, some of the icons of the anti-globalisation, like Naomi Klein, for instance, are not anti-capitalist at all. You know, they're pro-capitalist. If you read somebody like Naomi Klein, as it were, she's a Keynesian. She's basically a Keynesian, you know, politics. You know, she's that kind of thing. But there is definitely a kind of anti-capitalist here. But even within it, I got a friend who was in the Occupy, you know, near St. Paul's, and they do everything by consensus there. Apparently, she was telling me that she wanted to put up a banner that was anti-capitalist, you know, real, very strident banner. They had a great debate and said, no, this would upset everybody. You know, it would upset everybody. And they ended up with a kind of, say, what we want is a nicer capitalism kind of thing like that. But what I'm struck with is actually what Trevor says, that, you know, this whole question of human rights and, you know, the stress that the police put, that everybody's got a right to protest, as it were, that these are all part of the legitimation of capitalism, in a sense. That, you know, one can't run a government or run capitalism purely on kind of power. You have to find ways of legitimising it, and a very key way of legitimising it is say that people have the right to protest. People, you know, people have these human rights, but, you know, you have to see where they're coming from. And there's all, you know, you probably know that there's all these great debates, you know, books and books and books about what is human rights, as it were. And there's some anarchists completely dismiss the whole idea of human rights, saying, well, you know, this is just a ploy, really, forget about it. And then there's others kind of come to the, you know, there are natural human rights, that we have basic rights as a human being. What I think you need to do is to realise that these are actually coming from the human rights things, like the, you know, Declaration of Human Rights, are coming from the state and they're coming from capitalism, but they're things that can be used. They can be used. The freedoms we are given actually can then be developed, widened, and in that sort of sense, you know.
That's just how you look at this.
Sorry,
capitalism is very individualistic. We know it's private. So the capitalist would love to have complete control of everything. He's an individual, bugger everybody else. But unfortunately, he needs a state. It's a most unfortunate for all capitalists, but then it turns out he's very fortunate because they build the roads and they police things for him. The banks would love to be uncontrolled, but if they're uncontrolled, the whole system would collapse. All these things are necessary now, they get built up. So the state is a necessary product of the mode of production. And all we want to do is change that mode of production so it's not private mode of production. It is publicly, commonly owned. And I think while we have this capitalist state, it's going to behave in all sorts of weird and wonderful ways, but perceived or misperceived, construed or misconstrued in the interest of capitalism or in the interest of public safety. And people may think they're doing the right thing for society. And we all often, we brought up as kids thinking the police are absolutely necessary for something other. Maybe these people feel that way. Unfortunately, that's part and parcel of the mixed bag of capitalism, and, as you know, and we've got to somehow negotiate that thing. It's not going to work in our interest all the time. In fact, most of the time it's going to be against us. The only thing we can do is say we want common ownership of the means of production, and all the problems we've got relate to the private ownership.
Just on the what I said just before, there was near my workplace there was a royal visit, and there was a copper and his community support officer, and they were asking people to move along the street, and I asked the police community support officer, by what right or power are you asking them to move? Which is standard response to them. And the PCSO went, I've been tasked with asking people to move along. I said, well, that's not an answer. That's not what right or power you have. So she calls the copper over, and the copper says, Terrorism Act 2006, Section 60. So I walk off, and I hear them congratulating each other on getting rid of me. So I walked around, back to my work, went on the computer, looked at the Terrorism Act 2006, Section 60. That turns out that's to do with financial regulations and the investigations. She meant the Terrorism Act 2000, actually. But at this point, I went back to her and said, I've got a printout here. And she said, I'm not debating this, move on or I'll arrest you for something. Something is now illegal.
A little.
Yes. That's what I need to be. Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to know, actually, what is protest? I mean, are we really seeing any real protest? Particularly in the Western world, I have to say. As a member of the Socialist Party, before I became a member, I could understand. I mean, I know about the riots in Notting Hill, the Brixton riots, you know, real riots, and all the tactics that you spoke of before were being used then. The kettling, the SPG, or whatever they called themselves, special police forces, tooled up in the back of the vans in Brixton, waiting to set off the trouble. But my main argument, really, is the lefties, who, no matter what situations occurred locally somewhere, they will come in, a certain group of them, I won't mention names, particularly those SWPers, who want to come in and hijack every single thing. Even the Stephen Lawrence thing they tried to get their hands onto, and to divert what the people themselves are trying to do, a peaceful protest, or, you know, try and make show how the police have misbehaved. I mean, the police have always misbehaved. You know, you've got two types of police. Those who do their job, who try to be helpful, who I've met when I'm in criminal activity, who've done the job, arrested me correctly and all the rest of it, and those who want to beat you up, stitch you up, and watch you go to prison and stuff. But back to these lefties who jump onto other protests and then turn it into the usual violence, you know, punch-ups and things being thrown and everything else. I'm quite angry with these sort of people. Even the Occupy movement, I know they've got some good things going for them, but they kind of like, you know, why can't they see over the wage and salary horizon? Why can't they just see that there's something bigger that we all have that can benefit us all, if that makes sense to you, if you can pick anything out of that?
I think often sort of protest, it's just like a release of tension, isn't it? And
you've hit one.
Someone going on a protest or on a demo, they wouldn't necessarily have much of an idea of what they want. They might just say, oh, you know,
it's a day out for them.
Yeah, I'm against such and such. I'm against, you know, I don't know, wage cuts or, or whatever. And I suppose partly it's also, as well as a sort of like a release of tension if you're feeling sort of angry or upset about something, without necessarily thinking of an alternative. And I think it's also, as well, where it maybe it's a bit more positive than that, it's like a sort of show of solidarity. Right. I suppose in that way, it fulfills a similar sort of function to going to a football match, in a way. In that, you know, you're with a group of people with some kind of sort of common aim, common goal. And sort of psychologically, that's quite important. That sort of fulfills a need, which protests also tap into. Even if they're not sort of focused on a particular outcome, like, you know, if there was a genuinely revolutionary protest, then that'd be a different kind of fish. But, sort of reformist or single issue protests, you know, it's more of a sort of a psychological thing rather than aiming for a particular outcome often.
Wouldn't that apply to a socialist demonstration?
Well, I'd like to be more focused and have more of a set goal.
That would be revolutionary.
There's a
big difference.
I got some lights in the air.
Yeah, do you think a lot of these protests are about people, you know, who have strong opinions about one thing or other and don't feel as though they don't have a voice or their ideas aren't just being represented in general?
Oh, sure.
I mean, that's what it's all about, really.
That's sort of part of the release of the tension thing, isn't it? Because if you feel as if you're not represented or you don't have a say, then...
It was not even just so that like their ideas, you know, aren't being actually presented, you know, in the general sort of in society itself. I mean, that, you know, you sort of like releasing tension. A lot of these like these riotous behaviours, that, you know, people want to sort of demonstrate the fact that they're, you know, being stopped by the police and haven't got jobs and and stuff like that. I mean, you make people aware of that they're there and they've got a problem.
Yeah, I was wondering, just quickly, yeah, I suppose it's, I suppose if you go along to the protest because you feel as if you haven't sort of got a voice or, you know, you're not represented, you're not going to, there's a limit to how far a protest can address that, isn't there? Because, I mean, like the anti-war demos, you know, they were mostly ignored. There was a lot of people putting forward their point of view, you know, against the war in Iraq. So even that, you know, you could say that was a coherent sort of single demand by the protesters not to go to war in Iraq. But even though they had that voice and they made that statement,
completely,
it was ignored, wasn't it?
That's the point. That was what a lot of people were incredibly. They got even angry about that because there was actually these huge demonstrations going on, 500,000. And even getting absolutely no media coverage at all. I mean, the idea going on at big demonstrations, supposedly the idea, well, that is where we will be heard and noticed if you put 500,000 people on the street. It was actually quite interesting, you know, you would get, there were some really big ones that just weren't reported at all. And then it's not just a conspiracy theory then, it's actually real, you know, we are against the war, we don't want to go to war. We have like one of the biggest demonstrations that the country's ever seen, and he gets 5 minutes on Channel 4 or something.
Right, I've got four hands in a row, so please be patient. First.
Just a small point, but I did a report on the summing up of the riots last year, and it was stated that a lot of the young opportunists who were writing and looting the shops and all that stated that they felt an immense freedom and excitement, a lot of the boundaries between the gangs and all that were dissolved just for those few hours, and they were assisting each other and looting these shops and raiding these shops, which I don't support right away. I mean, I think shoplifting is a great thing, I've always supported it. I don't support violence or, you know, burning or anything like that, but pilfering from businesses or whatever, I've always supported that. But I just think that for a few hours, these young workers in the maelstrom that they were in coherent behaviour, they felt free for once. They didn't achieve anything, it was just a complete anarchy and totally destructive, but it gave them a glimpse of something that was out with their completely humdrum, useless lives that are completely without hope. And I just thought that was an interesting sideline, you know.
Mike basically made my point for me, because what I was going to talk about was the anti-war demonstration in 2003. And yes, there was an example of people. It was an enormous demonstration, the biggest one, I think one of the biggest in recent years. And it was really, people just went and they made their point, basically. They seemed to let off steam and then just quietly got on with their lives afterwards. And that can happen in protests, can't it? Sometimes they lead on to something else and sometimes they don't. Because in that case, really, I think so many people felt like they're disenfranchised. It wouldn't matter who you voted for, the war was going to go ahead. So, yeah, that was it.
Well, Mike also touched on mine. Mine was the anti-war protest, which I understood was an actual global protest. It wasn't just in England or Britain. The other point was, how effective has there been an effective protest in the last 20 years? I really can't think of anything that's happened in all the protests that have gone on, all the, you know, small groups, large groups like the anti-war one and all the rest of it. You know, is protest an ineffective way of doing things now? And what would be the, you know, we're so used to it. I'm sick of seeing youngsters with their hairs in braids and, you know, the rich kids with their state-of-the-art cameras videoing themselves while they're protesting. I mean, it's all about their blogs nowadays and all that sort of thing, the message, or whatever the message is, seems to always get lost in the flurry of excitement and jubilation. For what?
Yes.
There was, I'd say 50 years ago, a rather big movement for anti-war protests.
CND.
There was I'm talking about Australia and America, the moratorium movements against the Vietnam War. Because we've got bombarded on television, you see the action every night. Mm. We don't see that. We didn't see that with the Iraq War and so on. So they probably controlled them differently. And of course, mothers' sons, especially in Australia, were being, it was an urn that was turned every month, and they picked out the 5th, the 19th, the 21st, the 32nd, whatever it was of the month. And so the kids born on that day, 17 years earlier or whatever, were conscripted to go and fight. That worked miracles in turning the population against the war. You think about that happening every month and seeing every night on television. Well, of course, this sort of thing has never... And the fact that they got their hides ripped out of themselves too by the North Vietnamese. That went on for years, and there were big, big protests. I know in Australia, I don't know about America. So it did work. I presume the media at least have learned not to do this sort of thing. Perhaps, I don't know, or maybe warfare is different now. It's all too clinical. They just fire something and it looks like a video game.
Yeah.
And they show it on television. Yeah! You see a great big square with a crosshatch in the middle and the circles going around like a stone thrown in the ripples of a pond, you know, and the building's gone.
Mm. Yes.
I'm beginning to disagree a little with the anti-war, Iraq war. I was on that demonstration and I was a million people in London, and it was a great big demonstration. It brought a lot of people, and solidarity together. But what I was finding interesting is that, you know, it really demonstrated the non-support of that war, and it really put whatever politician on the back foot. You know, a million people on the street all over the world, and they couldn't ignore it. And I think all the people that participate, all the politicians, are still, like, say, Tony Blair. He's totally tainted with this Iraq war. Okay. Now, what we would see is that, you know, it's not good enough to be just about against anti-war. We've got to be anti-capitalism and for socialism. Okay, we've got to follow through on, you know, on all of this. We've got to be focused. We've got to be conscious of our class position. Okay, that's my point.
The question was asked when it comes over to what was a protest, you know, in that sort of sense. It was just excluding the winning the war. I mean, what's other things that's been mentioned here? Pensions and so on. Doctors are going on strike. There's a whole range of things that workers are under attack just now. But how do you solve these problems? Well, a lot of it, because it's money, a money system, it's going to go back to the wage system again. Because where workers are going to try and get back that what they're losing at the moment, they can only do it through maybe strike action, through the trade unions and things like that. But even the trade unions are locked into a certain lots of rules that's laid down. The protesters are always trying to find a way where they can get say something without getting their heads back in, as it were, getting it done legally. Well, then workers are trying to renegotiate their continual weakening position by obviously maybe going to strike. And of course, the only way they can do that is obviously maybe through their trade unions and that. But the trade union movement itself isn't locked into sort of changing society either. They're actually blunt. Their existence is trade union officials and all the rest of it, as in existing in a capitalist society. They're not an organisation that's trying to get rid of itself or anything like that. They're part of that particular system. And so, of course, you use a protest, but the only thing that I can say is that if it's going to continue that way, there's no use in protest. What we've got to do, obviously, is to show folk that the answer to their protest is to change the system.
Exactly.
Yes. For years, people in the Western countries have been given the the state propaganda that we supposedly live in a free and democratic society. Just as for years in the Eastern Soviet Union, the state propaganda there was that they had some type of socialism or some type of communism. But now, I think, particularly in more recent years, we've got to the situation now where it's not just the protesters who realise the lack of freedom and the lack of democracy that we've got on a global scale, but also that the people who wouldn't dream today of taking part in protest, people who are not politically aligned, or some readers and people like that who might be quite right-wing in a lot of their attitudes, that they have been forced by the effects of capitalism to realise that they've got no real say in how this society is run at all. That's one point I thought that would be worth making, and then the other point is that if we've got any task in life, you have to think about how you approach that task, how you eradicate the problems, and what the solution is. For example, in gardening, if you've got an open for weeds growing on your lawn, or if you've got slugs attacking your plants, then you use some type of deterrent to get rid of them, to improve them, so that those plants won't be attacked again, so that those weeds won't appear again. Now, that's the same for any type of a task that we face in life, as I'm just saying. Now, obviously, the central task that we are talking about, the Socialist Party, is that instead of the weeds in our garden, is capitalism and all its attendant problems which it creates politically, socially, and economically. The problem with the protest movements is that in nearly every case we've seen them just trying to solve one weed problem, whereas there are many more weeds in the garden that might attack the plants. And that seems to be the problem. They're single issue groups, and they're still always, nearly always, operating within the narrow confines of capitalism. And so that the only real protest, effective one, is a protest that, yes, okay, highlights the basic problem, but not single issues, and puts forward some type of concrete program for a clearly defined alternative.
I just wanted to say, so I don't know how long the discussion's going on for, but I've quite enjoyed the last part of this discussion, hearing people I haven't really spoken before. And I just wondered, it's a very traditional form of the way in which we're organising the conference, isn't it? Podium lecture, which have been very good, actually, I've enjoyed them. And then going into this sort of neither small group nor terribly large group, which tends to get dominated. It's a bit like question time, dominated by five or six speakers, you know. And I just wondered if an alternative would be to split into smaller groups to have the discussion, which would then militate against grandstanding or whatever it might be, you know, that might happen. And I would find that, just a suggestion, but I'd find that easier to engage in those discussions rather than this kind of format, which tends to play to people's strengths who are used to public speaking, I suppose is what I'd say. For what it's worth. I mean, it might be too difficult to make a change, but you could separate the rooms off, you know.
Just a question on that one. I mean, with the format of the summer school, I'm being all that experimental, really. And I think that one thing that sort of comes together with something like that is that there are sort of two separate workshops going on at the same time, say, you know, with two smaller groups, what happens if one person wants to attend both? You know, it's,
well, you'd be discussing the same topic.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Obviously you'd miss out on some good contributions, but on the other hand, it would facilitate greater discussion, which I think would be to the benefit of the conference person.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get this sort of the type of sort of informal chats between the talks. So
people tend to gravitate to people. You know, like the speakers will gravitate together, the non-speakers, you know, or the old friendship group or whatever. Well, just an idea. It might be too difficult to change it.
No. But also, we're recording this, so we couldn't record two groups. So. We'll have two recordings.
That's a lame answer, I think.
I think that's just a little good point to just remind everyone. I think it's October the 20th we're doing a campaign workshop.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
For how we're going to move a little forward.
Right, well, I was about to put a final warning. Does anyone else have anything you want to say? Or shall I ask the speaker to wind up?
I just make one small point. I mean, people say about these protests like single issue things. I think a lot of people are beginning. I think if you're going to change from capitalism to socialism, you've got to sort of, first of all, have a pretty good idea of what capitalism is and how it works.
Very true.
And I think, you know, in the last 10 or 20 years in particular, people do have a much better understanding of what it is. And they're all, and each individual protest movement protesting about one thing or other are beginning to quite correctly identify that there is a common root cause, you know, to all the problems. So I think it's all very well seeing capitalism, but you've got to understand what capitalism is and how it works, you know, in a basic format. And I think a lot of people do understand that now.
I just wanted to make one last point on the riots. Sorry to keep banging on about, but. The reason I got so vexed by that comment, the mindless comment, is because, and Janet will confirm that in the Middle East, all those political revolutions started with protests, with rioting and looting. We wouldn't call the media were calling them, you know, great acts of courage standing up against dictators. Whereas it happens in our country, it's mindless savages running riot, you know, the scum of the earth and all the rest of it. And that's how it's described. It's mindless when we do it here, because why would anyone protest against our government? Why would anyone be angry at our government? It's unfathomable to them. But, I mean, that's the contradiction, I think. And I just dislike the term mindless. A lot.
Because my name is mentioned, I have to come back on this one.
Yeah.
No, I didn't say in going back. No, in any way that the protests in the Middle East were all started through rioting and vandalism. No, they weren't. Most of them were. No, you've got the wrong side of this. They were very peaceful to begin with. Peaceful.
Yeah.
You know, that's
the whole. Yeah.
So we'll have to
have
this conversation.
Yeah. Can I just say something, picking up on Janet's point? I remember watching the Arab Springs, or whatever they called it, where the soldiers had come out, the military had come out, and were telling the people, the section that I saw on the news, we are not going to shoot you. Mm-hmm. And I really felt good. It was when I said, was any of these stuff effective, I take it back, because I saw working class even, you know, behaving as we should. Whether they shot them afterwards and all the rest of it, I don't know, but you're right, they started the jobs peacefully. And it's an entirely different thing. young hooligans running around.
I
don't even know why they called them riots.
You know what, that's exactly the same.
I don't know why they call them riots. I lived through Notting Hill Gate riots. I walked up streets to houses with my mum where it was no dogs, no coloureds, no Irish. I've lived through shit in this country. I lived through the Brixton riots. I've been beaten up by the police whilst pregnant. I've been in Holloway Prison where there were women, mothers, sitting there because they didn't pay the fine for the television licence that they were watching. I mean, you know, there's so many things one could get upset about and uptight about, but they were not riots. All they gained is some street cred and a life of poverty because they won't get work. They've got criminal records. When you're young, you don't realise.
Why don't you go a bit one step further and, as David Cameron described them, as rats? And funny enough, Gaddafi did the same thing with his people.
One moment, I have to come back, Speaker. I was one of the worst members of this party to go on record on this party saying how disgusted I was that even members were using that. But I'm not going to stand here. You know, I want socialism. I'm sick of tinkering around as Stairfoot's it with capitalism. I'm sick of all this nonsense of, oh, let's go and have another protest. I'm hoping that the transport workers, when they go on strike in London, I think it's the 25th, the 26th and the 27th of July, possibly during the Olympics and everything else, I hope that this is going to spark a revolutionary spark with some of them, and maybe we can get to talk to some of these union leaders and tell them to start telling them to abolish the wage and salary system instead of all this nonsense.
We know what the party wants. We know what we want. I take that as a given, you know. What I'm trying to do is explain what's happened and what is happening.
We've seen it all before. Well,
I think this is devolving into a session, so... Right, and I think 2 hours is long enough for a session to last, so if you want to go and have private fights, head up. I can ask our speaker to see if we're white.
Extending the conversation about my use of the word mindless. I'll stick by it, but don't forget that wasn't really the thrust of the talk. It was only sort of one part of it. Just to reiterate, I sort of used that expression to differentiate between those events of last summer from organised protest demonstrations, which are usually attached to a particular group, you know, being Stop the War Coalition or Hunt Saboteurs, or so. I sort of use it to sort of differentiate from more overtly political protests. Although I'm sort of asking Steve what I said, but I think it's been a very interesting discussion afterwards, and hopefully some of that was leading to the next upcoming session. You know, in what we've talked about afterwards about how successful can the protest be. Hopefully we'll be able to sort of, expand on that issue in the next session about the Occupy movement, which has raised the stakes, if you like, of what protests can be. So, hopefully there'll be some more interesting discussion coming up in the next session. But I hope my talk wasn't too grim. I realised again halfway through I was reading it that it was the same thought that popped into my head last time I did a talk. Oh, this is all grim and depressing. So I hope I haven't said depressing too much and you found something of interest and a few things to sort of think about in what I spoke about.
Definitely.
Thank you.